Well, welcome to the second hour of The Real Deal with Orbert Davis on 90.9 FM WDCB. And this is our segment that we call Sitting In, Jazz Conversations. And I like thinking of it as having a guest host, because we want to do more than just talk about what we do, but we can talk about how we do it and hopefully inspire you and others in the process. But I'll be honest, we're inspiring ourselves, especially today, because my guest is Brad Good. And holy cow, how long have we've known each other? And to be honest, Brad, I think our careers sort of paralleled and kind of circled around each other in Chicago.
That's certainly true. We go back to the early 80s at least, right, you know. Right. So it's been a minute now.
I didn't know you were born in Chicago.
Yeah, I'm from Chicago and lived there till I was 14.
Oh, okay.
And my parents moved to Michigan just as I was beginning high school. Uh-huh. And just as I was finishing high school, my parents moved back to Chicago.
Oh, okay.
So I started playing jazz in Michigan, but Chicago's always been home.
That's right. And yeah. At a young age, you were performing at the Green Mill quite regularly.
Yeah. I was there on opening night when Dave opened it.
Is that
1986,
right?
Yeah.
Holy cow. Yeah. Was it a Wednesday?
I don't remember if it was a Wednesday, but I do remember everybody dressed up like gangsters and flappers. It was quite a scene.
Wow.
Yeah.
And I know that you were a mainstay on Wednesdays for quite a while.
12 years.
12 years.
Yeah.
And how old were you, if I may ask?
When I started at the Green Mill, I would have been 23, I think.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And yeah. I had a band full of master players with Lynn Halliday and Jody Christian, Thomas Palmer, and
Kelly? Was Kelly playing with you?
Not at that time.
Okay.
But Thomas Palmer was on bass.
Okay.
You remember Tyaz?
Right, right.
Yeah. Wonderful bass player.
Yeah.
And I was very fortunate to be able to talk those people into working for me. And I was the one who shouldn't have been on the stage.
Oh,
you know?
No. Wow. Okay, let's go back to Lynn Halliday. What did you learn, if you could briefly just
Well, if
take
you
us back.
If you're fortunate in your lifetime, you'll have a friend like Lynn Halliday. He was a wonderful person and a very generous man and a very sweet person. And just took so much time with me to explain harmony and explain music to me. It was also a bit of a challenge because he'd had a challenging life and he had some personal mm-hmm. difficulties. So it was a bit of a job to get him to and from the gig and make sure he was at the gig and make sure the
really?
Gig was going to happen.
Is that right?
But when he played, it was magic. And all of us loved Lynn. You know, he was a great friend and a great mentor to all the young musicians at that time.
Wow.
And I just being able to sit and trade horn solos and trade choruses with Lynn, you know, forced me to rise to another level.
Sure. Oh, know? My goodness. Well, let's take a break and let's listen to something from your first CD, right, in 84. No, you were 24.
So 1988, I think, the CD came out on Delmark.
Right.
Bob Kester's label.
Right, Shaka the New.
Yeah.
All right, so lead us into which track would you like us to check out?
This one is called A Tribute to Clifford and Sonny. And I wrote it because Lynn Halliday loved Sonny Rollins so much, and I loved Clifford Brown so much.
There you go.
So I wrote a tune. I thought I'd like to write a tune that sounds like something they might have played.
Got it. All right. Well, here it is.
Yeah.
A tribute to Clifford and Sonny. And I'm sitting in with Brad Good. Thank you. Wow, that is like Clifford and Sonny.
Well, thank you. We did our best. You know?
Oh, well, don't we try. This is The Real Deal with Orbert Davis on 90.9 FM WDCB, sitting in with Brad Good. And Brad, it doesn't seem like it's been that long since you left Chicago, but you actually went to college here as well, or at least your master's.
I got my master's degree in bass at DePaul, which right. I know is a common school for both of us.
Yeah.
And I studied with Larry Gray there.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
Okay, first question is, are you switching the bass or are you adding bass?
I'd always been a string player. I started on violin when I was a little kid and played some rock guitar in high school and played bass in the orchestra. And when I went to college, I went to the University of Kentucky to study the trumpet. I studied with a very well-respected trumpet master, Vincent DiMartino.
Oh, yeah.
And I kind of promised myself that if I was going to put the bass down, that I would pick it up again later. So when I was auditioning for grad schools, I was auditioning as a bass player. And at DePaul, they wanted me to play trumpet in the jazz band, so they kind of made me a deal. They said, well, you know, your bass playing is maybe almost good enough to be accepted, but if you'll play trumpet in the jazz ensemble, we'll give you an assistantship to come to school. And so I was able to study the bass and really get serious about it while I was there.
Okay, well, psychologically, how do you think? Does one influence the other? Or
absolutely. When you're a bass player, there's no opportunity for lying. So you have to be completely aware of the harmony and completely responsible at every moment, and you have to be making harmonic decisions all the time. And I think that that really shaped the way that I play as a trumpet player.
Interesting.
Yeah.
That makes sense because a little lesson for our students. Let's say you're playing in a minor mode. If you switch that six around, you're changing modes, which actually change the tonality.
Yeah.
In a sense, yeah.
Yeah. I say, you know, it's not fair being the bass player because if you're a baseball player and you go up to bat, 3 times out of 10, you get a hit, you're an all-star. But if you're a bass player, you miss one note, everybody in the band turns around and stares at you. Like there's something wrong, you know.
And they say, you don't get a solo on this tune.
Yeah. So, I mean, being a bass player is a lot of responsibility. And I still play. I play a lot today. But it's been an on-again, off-again thing with the bass. It's been periods where I played and periods where I put it down for years and picked it up again. And so at this point, I'm going to try to keep my chops together.
Yeah, that's cool. So at what point did you make the decision that trumpet would be the main instrument, though?
Well, there was one moment not too long after I had finished school at DePaul. I had an audition with Sun Ra as a bass player. And I played a set with him at the Jazz Showcase. And he wanted to hire me, and I turned the gig down because I realized that if I had taken that gig, not only would it have been a very unusual lifestyle playing with Sun Ra, which was a little scary to me at the time, to be honest.
How old were you then?
I was about 24, 25.
Okay. All right.
This is that same time period.
Sure.
But I realized that that was a decision to put the trumpet down and go on the road and commit to playing the bass, and that was really not what I wanted to do. I really wanted to play the trumpet.
But it's great to have that option, though, you know?
It's different. I suppose so, yeah.
That's different, yeah. So before we take you out of Chicago, I want to talk about mentors again. We talked about Lynn. Yeah. Von Friedman.
Von Friedman was my hero.
Okay.
And when I was coming back to Chicago after college, I thought I wanted to study with Von Friedman.
Okay.
And so I went to him and I asked him for lessons. And he said to me, come on now, Bradskis. You know that jazz cannot be taught.
Uh-oh.
And that's what he said.
Okay.
But then he said, but just keep hanging around and you will figure it out.
Mm.
And so I took him very literally, just keep hanging around. I made a study of Von Friedman. I was at the apartment lounge every Tuesday night. I didn't take gigs on Tuesday nights because I went to the apartment lounge for my lesson. And eventually, you know, Von asked me to start playing with him. Mm-hmm. And, you know, talk about being challenged and being pushed. I mean, I think of Von Freeman as one of the great soloists and creative forces in the history of jazz. I think his music should be taught in the universities the way we're teaching about Charlie Parker and John Coltrane. I think Von's contributions and his style are worthy of that kind of study. Mm. And that's how I was thinking then. So it was a very, very big influence on me, not just in terms of the music, but in terms of how he dealt with being an artist, in terms of how he dealt with being a soloist, how he dealt with being a performer, how he dealt with the life of a musician. And, you know, I have to say probably my strongest influence.
Okay, so thinking about what you just said, when we think of music programs, we tend to think theoretically first. But the thing that you said that Von gave you and demonstrated was beyond the notes. So yes. How, as an educator, can we, as collectively, my listeners as well, bring that to the classroom or make that a standard?
Well, there's a difference between teaching and mentoring. And I think we need to be mentors to our students. Yeah. We need to be examples for them. And we need to provide a context for them where they can discover their own creative voice, but still be able to work with us, not under us. And I believe very strongly in that. I've always tried to run a jam session everywhere I've been in the tradition of Von Freeman, because I think the jam session is the perfect environment for learning, but only as long as the older musicians are willing to participate and be there for the younger musicians.
Exactly.
You know, and I think we could look at that in the schools. I think we could say, you know, what are the values? What's the ethos of the jam session? What is taught? What is not taught is a good question. And as I was coming up around these great, you know, mentors, people like Jody Christian and Von Freeman, Ira Sullivan, all the people that I consider to be my teachers, nobody ever told me what to play. Mm. Nobody talked about that with me. That was something you were supposed to come up with yourself, you know? And so I think about that in terms of the curriculum of the jazz program, you know, and I know that jazz education is still in its infancy, and we're still trying to figure out which way to go. But we might consider that before jazz was in the schools, people were still learning to play jazz very well.
Right.
And there might have been something to the way they were learning.
Oh, my goodness. That's
and,
right.
And
that's
we might look at that and try to bring that environment into the classroom.
Okay. Well, you sound like a rebel against the system. So you have been an associate professor of jazz for how many years now?
Well, a long time. I taught part-time in Chicago at the American Conservatory. Mm-hmm. And then I was 7 years at the Cincinnati Conservatory full-time. And now I'm in my 16th year at the University of Colorado. So it's been a while. I've been teaching for 30 years.
Are you able to bring those concepts that seem to go against higher education to the classroom?
Yes.
Wow. Tell me more.
Well, I mean, I structure a syllabus and I present things in an organized fashion, but it's the philosophy of what's being presented.
I love it.
You can still call the class jazz improvisation.
Right.
That doesn't mean you have to teach chord scales.
All right.
And we're talking about other things.
There you go.
And there's certain things I won't talk about. Mm-hmm. I believe if a student wants to transcribe solos, learn the great solos of the masters, they absolutely should do that. But I won't tell them which ones to do.
Nice.
You know, it's up to the student to find his or her own voice.
Okay. So I have to ask you, what about the concept of juries? Having the end of semester jury where you have this big test to play.
Yeah, well, let's hear you play. I think it should be more like a jam session.
There you go.
And so we have them play with the faculty. The whole faculty is there, and they know what tunes they're supposed to know, and we see if they're progressing, see if they're keeping pace in their program.
You asked me off microphone earlier if I was still teaching in university level, and I said no, and that's one of the reasons why I don't, because I tried to do that, and it went against the concept of what we know, hundreds of years of, in a sense, classical training,
yeah,
that jazz education has sort of been the round peg forced in that square hole, right, and it doesn't work.
Well, I think I'm very fortunate. I'm in a school where they're very supportive of what we do, and they let us design our program the way we want to design it and give us a lot of autonomy. So I should count my blessings.
There you go.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to move forward just a little bit. One of my favorite albums of yours, and I play it quite often on The Real Deal, is Tight Like This, 2010.
Thank you.
All right, so set us up.
This is a song called Changes, and Tight Like This was kind of a little bit of an album that looked at jazz history,
mm-hmm,
and looked at some old tunes through a new lens.
Right.
This tune, Changes, by Walter Donaldson, was originally recorded by Bix Beiderbecke with the Paul Whiteman Orchestra, and Bix has the reputation of being a fine improviser who makes the chord changes. So the title is actually about chord changes. And if you hear the words, it's Bing Crosby is the lead singer on the recording. Uh-huh. They're singing about somebody who likes to play chord changes. And they're singing about Bix, really. And so I thought, well, this is a very simple tune and it doesn't have very many tricky changes. So I changed the changes and I made them even more rapid and more abstract. And then I took a step back and looked at it, and I said, no, that's not enough changes. And I took each chord and made it a disjunct atonal polychord.
Okay.
And so it's like this completely insane-sounding harmonic maze on this very simple-sounding Dixieland tune.
Wow.
And we play it in a very abstract way. So it's kind of taking the tradition, the old tradition, and some very forward-thinking performance practices and mixing it up.
That's cool. Well, all right, let's hear it right now. Here's Brad Good, Changes. That was the one and only Vonsky, Von Freeman, a teacher extraordinaire, as we heard from my special guest host, Brad Good, talking about the years with Von and various mentors in Chicago. That was called Ski Wee. I can see and hear Von saying that today. Okay, so we talked a bit about your first recording in 1988. And another recording in 2010. And we're going to play something from your latest recording. But I want you to be the critic now. I want you to analyze the trumpet player from these three periods.
Okay, that's a hard one.
I know.
the trumpet player on the first recording was too worried about being correct to be relaxed and in the flow. The trumpet player on the second recording was so relaxed in the flow that he wasn't that worried about being correct. And the trumpet player on the third recording is getting older and more used to playing. And I think that music is not like sports. You know, your career is not something you excel at when you're young and then ride off of for the rest of your life and remember your glory days. No offense to any athletes out there. Mm-hmm. But music is something that when you're young and you're apprenticing, you wish you could play it. And as you get a little bit older, you become more accustomed to playing it, and it takes a lifetime. I remember listening to Von Freeman during the years I was playing with him, and probably the years between when I was 25 and when I was 40, and it was the years between when he was 65 and 80, yeah. And he was improving faster than I was. Oh, he was, and... Wow. That's another way in which he was an example for me, that music is a lifelong pursuit. So one doesn't quit striving or trying to work on developing this stuff, as you know. Yeah. And so I think, you know, when I listened to early albums, I was very, very self-critical. Now when I hear recording back, it sounds exactly the way it sounded to me in the moment I was playing it. So I think there's more awareness, a little, maybe a little more maturity, a little more control over the elements.
Well, that's good. Well, that's definitely beneficial to us all, and especially to the trumpet player you're talking to now. I need to hear that. Oh, man. Okay, well, let's play something from your latest CD. That's right, and you're featuring one of my favorite musicians, Ernie Watts.
Yes, Ernie and I have become partners and very close friends in the last 4 or 5 years, and we're playing together all the time now.
Wow.
And it was a real honor to have him play on this record, and we're getting ready to do another one. The track I think I'd like to play is called Perplexity.
Okay.
And Adam Nussbaum is the drummer, and he joined the group a couple of years ago, and he just brings an intensity and a fire that is really, really exciting to play with.
Awesome.
Yeah.
All right. Well, here's Perplexity, Brad Good with Ernie Watts on The Real Deal with Orbert Davis. Thank you.
That's right.
This is 90.9 FM WDCB, The Real Deal with Orbert Davis. And that was Perplexity, my special guest host for this hour of The Real Deal, Brad Good. Thank you so much, Brad. That was awesome.
Oh, it's been my pleasure being here, Orbert. And it's great to be together with you after all these years.
Hey, but I have a confession. Being in the early 20s, when I heard of Brad Good, this amazing trumpet player, and, you know, I was busy doing my thing. My thing during the time was like studio work, you know.
I remember.
And yeah. I didn't like hang out at night as much as I should have. So all the things that you're saying today, I'm like, oh man, if I only would have, could have. But we can fix that. You got your horn?
Yeah, I think it's around here somewhere.
Well, we got to play something. In honor of I in Chicago and you in Colorado, and where it's very cold, we got to bring some heat, okay?
Yeah, that would be great.
Let's do it. That's the story of my life. You know, at the end of the most delicate moment, I drop the mute because I forget, like, where I am. But anyway, thank you so much, Brad. That was fun. I needed that.
That was fun.
Every show that we do in Sitting In, it's always just the beginning. So I promise we'll do that again sometime.
Okay.
All right.
That'd be great.
This is Orbert Davis, your host of The Real Deal with Orbert Davis on 90.9 FM WDCB. And a very special thank you again to my guest host, Brad Good. Thanks, Brad.
Thank you, Orbert.
great way to close out our second hour of The Real Deal, sitting in with Brad Good. That was Clifford Brown, Max Roach, and company with Jackie. And that's dedicated to Brad Good. Thank you so much, Brad, again. I tell you what we'll do. The next hour will be all trumpet players. I'm a trumpet player, so this is for Brad, this is for me, and for all of our trumpet-playing brothers out there. So stay tuned.